So just to kind of flash what we talked about yesterday, we were talking about density functionals. Okay, and we focused mainly on explicit density functionals for the kinetic energy. Okay, and so there were two examples. One was this, this von Weizsacker example. And for 1D, this is just a 1D case. And basically, you would find that T is given by, I'm just writing this out of my head, so check me on this. But it's given by, you just integrate over this funny combination of the derivative of the density over the density. And so this is already kind of interesting because it's exact. You guys remember what case is it exact for?
One-dimensional real or whatever.
Yeah, so one-dimensional, but then what's the other key thing you need for this to be exact? So it was, we did assume that the wave function was real and non-zero, or like non-negative, but kind of when was that the case that we could assume that? You know? So, what about like number of electrons?
Yeah, single electron.
Single electron, right? Exactly. So this is only the cool thing about this is it's totally exact, but only in this kind of very special case. But it still shows us like what we could expect maybe about density functionals. That that already, you know, we see that this one, like I mentioned, is beyond this LDA that we're gonna talk about later and sort of develop later because it involves this derivative of n. And just to give you a slight, you know, some understanding of some of the terminology you might see if you read review articles on this, for some reason the DFT community calls this non-local. What they mean is it's not ultra-local. So other people would call this slightly less local because it involves a derivative. I would call it sort of just pretty local still, but some people will say non-local. Just so you know, they don't mean actually totally non-local, just involving a derivative.
Can you give some intuition as to why we would ever like really want an analytic form for the density functional?
Yeah,
like,
so the question is why would you
doing
want
it all numerically? Like,
right, so why would you want an analytic form? Yeah, I mean, let's see, no, it's a good question, but I'm just trying to think about, like, you know, it sounds like it's sort of a matter of taste kind of question, I guess, right?
Yeah.
I mean, for some people, if you say, why would we, you know, some people are very kind of biased against doing things numerically because they kind of assume that this implies, like, that you're giving up a certain amount of insight in the problem, right? But, you know, it has its pros and cons, right? I mean, when you do an experiment, also, you don't get a formula, right? So it's like doing a thought experiment. You know, I think you know, having a if you can have a formula, it's sort of clearly always valuable if
right.
you can have it exactly, because then you can understand better what's going into it, basically.
But I would guess for a general system, the best density functional, if there were one, would be one that doesn't have a form.
Yeah, right. So the statement is that the best density functional wouldn't have a form you can write down. That's basically right. So I mean, it's sort of, you know, often people talk about if you could write it down, and I just, you know, I think it's pretty clear that that's a that's sort of never going to happen. I mean, there's never going to be a form that anyone's going to write down that's somehow going to cover all the cases. It's really, as we'll see, it's more like helpful just to know that this thing exists. And it's like it's more like knowing that there's a relationship, knowing that there's a map. And just that gives you some confidence to develop numerical techniques. That's sort of usually the way it's gone. So another question.
When you introduce density functionals, you emphasize that they could sort of look like literally any map you write down. And then you... But it's subject to the constraint that when you put in the actual ground state, you get the actual energy. Is there any other constraint?
Yeah, that's right. So the question is, you know, that it's this formal map, but it has properties we know, right? Like if you put in the ground state density, you get the ground state energy. That does imply constraints. So right. So that's how a lot of these partially writable kind of functionals that people have developed, that's how they come about. So the LDA, we'll write it, you know, more or less. And then I'm going to refer to that there's some curve that's fit, and I may write that curve, or I may tell you about how that fit works, but you know, we're more or less going to write out kind of what LDA is. Then after LDA, there were developed these things called generalized gradient approximations. The reason they say generalized is because straight gradient approximation, where you just try to put in a naively kind of account for derivatives doesn't work that well for all these technical reasons. So people kind of stepped back from this kind of analytical derivation of them and came up with more of like a, as far as I understand, kind of like more of an empirical form that they developed by kind of getting to your question, by asking more and more about like what different asymptotic limits would this thing have, or how would it behave in different cases. And basically, yeah, applying a lot of physical constraints to how this density functional ought to, or pieces of the density functional ought to behave. And then by sort of doing this, they were able to tighten down the screws on some form for the functional that involved derivatives of the density. So people have applied this kind of thinking to kind of constrain forms. But then this doesn't lead to like a unique density functional once you add these gradient corrections, because it sort of amounts to like which constraints you choose to apply, basically. So we can talk more about that. I may not have much time to go through any of that story, and it's a bit technical. That was just one example. The other example was this Thomas Fermi, which you guys explored a bit in the tutorial yesterday, right? And so, so can someone summarize again what's the assumptions behind Thomas Fermi? Right, it's not exact in any kind of case where of a finite number of electrons, but what was kind of the step of assumptions going into driving Thomas Fermi? So I'll write the form in one case. So we wrote the case for spinless electrons, and so I'll show you the results for if you put spin in and assume they're unpolarized, in 1D, the Thomas Fermi approximation for the kinetic energy is n cubed of x with this different prefactor. So this is with spin 1D. And then in 3D, there's actually even a crazier prefactor. So it's and it's a good exercise to try to derive this. I mean, it's just sort of a geometry problem where you just define that there's like a sphere of holding all the electrons in the Fermi sea. And then you just define its radius to be the Fermi momentum. And then you just say, okay, well, the number of points inside has to give me the number of particles back if I doubly occupy all the states that fit inside, and then you just kind of go by consistency. Just because of geometry and dimensionality, you get a different power. Okay, so just to flash some other versions of Thomas Fermi. So this is one that's actually used in real calculations because it's in 3D and it's involving electrons with spin, here assumed to be doubly occupying every state. I mean, you could then generalize it where you have different amounts of polarization, like an imbalanced population of ups and downs, say. But what was the key approximation going on here?
Wave functions slowly vary.
Yeah, that's right. So that's right. I shouldn't have said it's not exact in some limit. It's exact in this limit of non-interacting, totally uniform particles, right? Because then this is just not n of x, it's just n. So it does have this exact limit for a finite number. I shouldn't have said that. But yeah, exactly. If the density is slowly varying, it should be a good approximation. And also, as you saw from the tutorial, there's kind of another interesting limit, which is in the limit of very high density, right, in certain cases. So if you do this like particle in a box, even though it's not, it always has oscillations, somehow these account for a smaller and smaller relative fraction of the kinetic energy, and the dominant part is just this kind of, the fact that it's kind of getting relatively flat, this sort of thing. So, okay, so that's just kind of a little bit of just what we talked about yesterday. So now, you know, these are just, you know, kind of crude approximations. On some level, I mean, this one's exact, but you can only use it in some very limited circumstances. So now we're going to talk about how do you put this on a much more rigorous and firmer footing, right? So even though you can't always carry out this rigorous program fully, you can, just knowing that it's there helps people to develop better approximations. So again, we're considering this class of Hamiltonians, which I called H sub V, and it's some kinetic energy, some interaction. These are like operators. And then in second quantized notation, we have this external potential part. And again, this is the part that we vary. So this is our kind of right. So again, it's important to think about that we're sort of not allowed to touch this part, right? So we think of this as sort of a given, or fixed. Right, and as it was observed yesterday, we may eventually remove this part and try to play the whole game again, and then we can get some kind of interesting double map with the same density, and we can go to two different classes of systems. We'll be talking about that in a minute. But you know, so of course T is sort of has this given form. VE could be, I'm sort of leaving it general in many cases, but in 3D people actually work with the real Coulomb interaction. So this is really done in that case. So what Hohenberg and Cohn showed was that, let's say we have two Hamiltonians. Okay, so these are, let's call one H, and it's this thing H V. And then we also have this one H prime, which is short for H V prime. Okay, so it just has a different potential V prime. We want to have both to have a non-degenerate ground state. Okay. Let's call those ground states psi and psi prime, respectively. Okay. Now this can be generalized. This actually can be generalized to the case where there is a degenerate ground state. Basically, you just have to work with like ensembles of these ground states, so some like linear combinations of those ground states. But we're not gonna. It's just more technical, and it doesn't. The argument goes through very similarly, so it's not sort of that interesting to generalize it that way. We'll just focus on this case, and it works for many practical cases in real systems that are very complicated. This is sort of a fine assumption to work with, just to get the idea. So what we're trying to do, this kind of proof, later we'll do a more constructive way of approaching this theorem, but this is kind of one of these reductio ad absurdum kind of theorems, where we're going to make some more assumptions, and then eventually our assumptions are going to break down, right? So the final assumption that where things are going to break down is we want to assume that psi and psi prime yield the same density N of R, okay, so that would mean, that means that it's equal either to psi N hat of R, or if we put psi prime, that we get the same guy. Okay, that's our assumption. So basically our two key assumptions are that these two Hamiltonians are non-degenerate, and that their ground states yield the same density, right? So what we're going to see is that we can't keep both of those assumptions. We have to like drop one or the other. Or we have to drop an assumption about the potential going into these. Okay. Okay, so here's the, I should state what we're going to prove. So that if we make all these assumptions, what this implies, the theorem says that V of R and V prime of R only differ by a constant. So just that V of R equals V prime of R plus some constant C. Okay, so that's what we get. If we make all these assumptions, that's what their theorem says, is that really it's more or less just the same Hamiltonian. If all these things happen, so if they're non-degenerate, and then you finally have the same density, you can say, well, really, these potentials are actually the same potential after all. That's the statement of the theorem. So let's prove that. Okay, so it's one of those things where it's like, assume this not the case, and we'll show it has to be. So so what we'll do is we'll invoke the variational principle, which says that if we take these expectation values to get the energy, that that the ground state of H is always going to do better with the energy than if we put psi prime, take the expectation value with respect to psi prime, right? They could be equal, in a more general setting, but we've assumed this is the ground state of H, so it's got to be at least equal and usually lower. Okay, so then now the key step is that we peel off the potential energy part of H, right? So this is where it gets to be important that this one part is fixed for both, and they only differ in this other part involving V, right? So this implies that so now this is no longer an operator. This is actually the density N that we assumed these both have. Okay, so then that's the same on both sides, so we can cancel it off. So we can say, just by this assumption that they have the same density, they have to have the same external potential energy, right? So that implies that but then we can kind of flip it around. So we can say, by the same argument, that we can, of course, it must be the case that if we now take expectation values of H prime, right, that the thing that's assumed to be the ground state of H prime has to do better in energy than any other wave function, namely psi. And so that's going to imply the other. That's going to imply this kind of inequality the other way around. So we're going to see that psi prime does better on this part of the Hamiltonian. Does better or the same. So then, since we have both versions, it has to be the same. They have to actually give the same value for this, right? So it really must be that this is actually an equality. Right, just to write it out really clearly. So that implies that so basically, now just in words, what this tells us then is that since they do equally well on this, you know, kinetic plus interactions part of the energy, and they have the same potential energy, that means they just have the same energy, right? So they're both ground states of either Hamiltonian, but we assume that these Hamiltonians were non-degenerate, right? So something broke down. That's basically it, right? That's the proof. So, I mean, it's a little bit subtle, but we assume they had a unique ground state, right? And then we assume they had the same density. So in the end, it just has to be that the only way out of this is that the V's just differ by a constant. So really, they weren't different Hamiltonians in the end. You know, basically, we pretended like they were different Hamiltonians, but then we found that if we tried to make all these assumptions go through, they were really just the same Hamiltonian in disguise. That's basically it. So it's a little bit subtle because it's not constructive, right? You know, we just sort of reached a contradiction. So we'll do in a minute a more constructive argument about why this correspondence goes through. But basically, you know, if you reflect on this, it's telling you that that basically the density, whatever density you get, implies the potential that it came from. Okay, so it tells you that N of R determines V of R. Right, so we tried to imagine that these two wave functions, which had the same density, came from different potentials, and then we weren't able to make that go through.
Sorry, may I ask a question?
Yeah.
But is it possible that, for example, we have different V's, but the same matrix elements?
So, okay, yeah, I see what you're getting at. So this is, it's very subtle, right? We have to kind of soak in this a little bit.
For example, okay, right. Suppose that we have, for example, I don't know, potential L, okay, and then one V has potential like this, okay, and the other V has potential like this, okay. So the functions, okay, they will be just reflected, and the matrix elements will be the same.
Okay, so you're saying maybe just one is like the reflection of the other or something.
Yeah.
Okay. That's a very clever case, actually. Yeah, I hadn't thought about that one. So this is not like a very rigorous proof. Maybe I have to put.
Then wouldn't you get different densities to ground state?
Oh yeah, that's right. You would just get, okay. That's okay. So that case I think is easy to defeat. Good suggestion. So if they're just sloping different ways, you get different densities. Good point. Right? You know,
this,
I mean, you would just check that case and see that if one potential sloping the other way, one's, you know, if they're the reflection, if one wave function is a reflection of the other, the potentials. I mean, physically those are pretty different, right? If you just walk around to the other side of that system, it's the same physics on either side. But here we're defining, you know, a positive direction for x or, you know, for r or something. So we have to treat those as different densities. Right?
what you've done here, you just shown that the ground stays the same. But I can imagine like taking the Hamiltonian matrix and then just like getting rid of that dimension and then repeatedly iterating this argument so I get that not only are the ground states the same, actually the full Hamiltonian has to be the same. Well, it's got the same, all the cycle states are the same for both the two cases.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point. So then once you've kind of argued that they just differ by a constant, their whole spectrum of these Hamiltonians actually comes out the same. Right?
Yeah, right. I mean, that like you've just shown that the ground state is the same. You have to go a bit further to actually get the that they only differ by a constant, right?
No, I think it comes out, right? I mean, I think this is enough to argue that. Because, you know, what I mean is, it depends on what you want. You can let go of different assumptions at this point. You know, you've reached some kind of contradiction, so you can resolve this contradiction in different ways. So you could say, oh, maybe they don't have the same density. Well, that's fine, but then that's not quite as interesting, maybe. I mean, that's sort of consistent to say, well, maybe they didn't have the same density after all, and then that's totally fine, because then that's leading to what I'm saying, which is that we could just say, well, they have different densities, and they have different potentials, as we kind of originally were imagining, and that's totally fine. What I'm trying to say, one way of resolving this is to say, let's continue to cling to that they have different potentials, and they have the same density, and then what you find is that the difference, they do have different potentials, but it's like a trivial difference at most. You know, that's what you find, is that you can have everything your way. You can have different potentials, same density, non-degenerate ground states. It's just that the difference you find in the end of the day is extremely trivial, and it's sort of totally meaningless from the point of view of what kind of wave function you get. So yeah, that's it. So they have non-degenerate ground states, but in that case, you just find that it's the same wave function.
Yeah.
Right. So you can either have same wave function, or you could have different densities. You can break out of this problem
so
in many different ways.
You can say that you could just say that they've got the same ground state wave function.
That's right.
Anything else about the rest.
That's right. Yeah. You can resolve it different ways, and then the point is that there's sort of less interesting ways to resolve it and more interesting ways to resolve it. And one of the most interesting ways is to realize that knowing the density now specifies the potential. I'm going to, you know, say up to a constant and then not belabor this point in what I'm saying afterward, right? So when we say equal potentials now, we're going to mean, you know, in some equivalence relation where we define everything up to a constant, right? So,
I understand all of what you wrote on the last board here, but I don't get the final conclusion still.
Yeah, that's fine. So this is good to just like soak on this.
So you can't just like...
We'll do it more constructively too.
You can't just take like proof by contradiction and then you don't get to choose which of your assumptions is wrong. Like one of your assumptions is wrong.
Yeah, well that's a good point. But the point is
that even if you do have both ground states being the same, if that's the assumption that's wrong, mm-hmm. when I cut those two ground states out, I look at the Hamiltonian on every other state, I apply this again for like the next two lower states, I just keep going up. I find all my ground state, all my eigenstates mm-hmm. are the same.
Well, but the thing is, so formally what you said about once we have reached a proof by contradiction, it doesn't tell us which assumption is wrong.
Yep.
Formally, that's correct from like a pure logic point of view. But we know more things than we just proved, right? So we know, for instance, if you take the same Hamiltonian and another Hamiltonian that's only shifted by a constant, we know that its spectrum of wave functions of excited states is going to be the same just from like experience with quantum mechanics. I mean, and probably you can just prove this. It's probably pretty trivial. It's probably just some mathematical result about Hermitian operators that you can just draw on or something, right? It's the same Hamiltonian, right? I mean, it has to have the same properties, right?
Yeah.
We know this, right? So what I mean is we can feed in other facts that are clear from the study of quantum mechanics into this afterward, right?
Yeah.
So what I'm trying to say is that we have a choice about which one of these assumptions we now drop, and but then different choices lead to more or less interesting conclusions. So we can say, oh, well, maybe we'll drop the thinking that they have different Vs, and we'll just say, okay, they're only differing by a constant. We know what happens then, right? We know that it's basically the same Hamiltonian for all intents and purposes. So so then we know that case. So a more interesting case is to now say, well, maybe they don't have the same density after all. That's the most interesting case, it turns out. Because that's what we have to let go to keep the potentials being different in a non-trivial way. That's the resolution. So I haven't still gotten... I still haven't gotten to your question. So you were saying, what did we show?
I guess I don't see the contradiction.
Right. So the contradiction was, so maybe, maybe because I didn't write out the very last sort of bitter end step. Right? So the...
Contradiction is we assume the signs are from different ground states.
Yeah. The contradiction was that when we put back in the potential energy, so it shows that if these are equal, it shows that then these are equal, that psi...
Oh, okay.
You see what I'm saying? Right? So if we just put back in the potential energy, which we can do because it's the same on both sides because the densities are the same, by assumption, then we get that they have the same energy, but we assume they didn't, right?
Right.
That's the contradiction, right? So yeah, I don't mind going slowly through this or talking about it because it's very
But why does
subtle.
That give you that the V's are differed by a constant?
Sorry?
What does that give you that the V's are differing by a constant?
Why is that like an interesting conclusion, you mean?
Why is the conclusion in the end that the V's have to differ by a constant?
Well, it's essentially more the conclusion that the V's are the same, but you know, that's as close as we'd like it. Ideally, we would just say we find that they're the same, but we really can't totally get all the way to that, so the most we can get is that they differ by a constant. Let's think about that, right? So again, so what we found is that, I should write, yeah, okay, right. So this is here. We have a choice of which V we put back in, right? So I just put back in V. I'll put a parenthesis on a prime like this. So just to be careful how we make this last step. So what we did is here I just arbitrarily chose to take expectation values of H. You know, so we proved this fact, right, with our assumptions. Then I just put back in V, the potential coming from H. And we see that we get the expectation value of H is the same with both wave functions, but we assumed it wasn't. Right? We assume that these guys have non-degenerate ground state. So that's the contradiction. We also could put back in V prime, and that's taking the expectation of H prime. Again, same energy. That's where the constant comes in, right? We can show that they give the same energy on H or the same energy on H prime, but that doesn't mean that the energy on H equals the energy on H prime for these two guys. It just means that they give the same energy to whichever Hamiltonian you apply them, but that doesn't mean that that energy that comes out is the same number in both cases. You see what I mean? So that's where the constant is coming in. Just that there's some overall energy shift we contributively put into one of the two. But otherwise, what we found out is that they're totally the same otherwise in the physical level, that they have the same physics, the same ground state wave function, the same V up to some trivial difference. And okay, right? So yeah, this should shock you. I mean, this is sort of my goal, is like, I want you guys to be a little bit like confused or sort of thinking this can't be right, because the consequences are vast of this, right? But I mean, if you think about it a little harder, this is a very formal statement, right? And it probably does break down in sort of meaningful ways when you go to more, like we'll see that it works in practice for sort of weakly correlated systems where the density has a lot of information about the physics. But my belief is, I don't know if this has really been investigated, it's probably a bit of a frontier of research, but if you go to more strongly correlated systems, it may be that the densities differ by some really tiny amount. And so this theorem still goes through in some formal sense, but the difference in physics is encoded in some really tiny difference in some tails of the density or something like this. And so in a practical level, this map I'm about to describe maybe isn't always so useful. So what we find is that one way out of this contradiction is to say that they don't have the same density, right? Like if we want to continue to think that they have different Vs, like substantially different Vs, then they don't have the same density. Then if you flip that around, it's telling you that having different densities means you have to have different potentials. That's sort of the flip around that you get from this. So it tells you that there's a map that if you know the density, it means it can only have come from one potential, again, you know, up to a constant, right? And that's the deep part, right? Because then once you know V, that uniquely determines the ground state wave function, right? Which we know determines basically everything. Everything ground state, you know, maybe even more than ground state, but at least everything about the ground state. Question.
When you originally wrote H V, the operator, is that supposed to be a Hamiltonian on the Hilbert space that's taking in psi vectors and a normal Hamiltonian?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's supposed to just be a regular well-behaved Hamiltonian. So there are some other assumptions I didn't really like bother with here. I mean, not assumptions, but details. Like, so probably to make this rigorous, you have to say we're working in a fixed particle number sector. But I think that's already clear because we assume they have the same density, so fine. And then you probably have to make assumptions about maybe kind of getting to your objection about trying to think of ways out of this with different reflections of densities and things. It probably, again, this is where I'm not an expert on the more rigorous details of this, but probably you have to make assumptions about boundary conditions as well. I would assume the safest situation to talk about all this is in the case where you think about large but finite systems with the density decaying very fast out in the tails of the system. I mean, that's probably, because otherwise you can probably do all kinds of shenanigans with tweaking the density very far away in some arbitrarily small, you know, some region where it's arbitrarily small or on some infinite system and hiding differences out at infinity. Or you could probably play around with it a lot if you if you were trying to be overly general about it, I would guess.
So it's when you write N in that expression for the Hamiltonian, I mean, I see, I guess, how that Hamiltonian gives you an energy if you give it an eigenstate, but as something that's mapping states to states, it seems sort of unclear because N takes a state, gives this density, and then the integral gives a number, and so on. It's not like a, doesn't look like an operator.
So I don't think I caught your question, though. Like,
the question is, I'm confused because H doesn't look like an operator.
Oh, well, in what way? Because, I mean, so it's the kinetic energy operator. It's the interaction operator.
Yeah, so the third term, I guess.
Oh, okay. Well, the third term is written in second quantization, so it's a function times the density operator, which is just psi dagger psi.
Then I'm fine. Thanks.
Okay, you're cool with
I
that.
Yeah,
good question. I see. So you were thinking that with this N with the hat over it, maybe that was already, I'd already fed the density in.
Yeah,
exactly. Okay. So that notation is, I like it because it shows you that that's going to become the density, but maybe it's almost a little too subtle because it almost looks like I just put it in.
It's fine.
Okay, exactly. So that maybe I should have written psi dagger psi on that part. Thanks for bringing that up because I don't want there to be any confusion about that. So let's.
Probably in the first quantized form, there should be no integral, I guess.
Yeah, in the first quantized form, there's just a sum over the positions of the particles, each plugged into V. So it's in the first quantized form, it's like H is T plus VEE, which I can write also, but JV R J, where R is the position operator, right? Right, because you have some N particles, and each one feels this potential. So you have to put that in N times.
You mean the sums over the particles?
Mm?
You mean the sums over the particles?
That's right, sums over the particles. Great. Okay, so reflecting a little bit more on this, right? So another way of saying what we've shown is that if you think about the maps from Hamiltonians defined for different Vs, that we've shown that each one gives, of course, each one gives some density, right? You get some ground state density from solving each one. You just solve it and then see what you get. And what we're showing is that there's a certain thing that can't happen, which is that if we put in, so you know, maybe there's a few different potentials we'll try and we'll get different densities. But what we're showing is that this can't happen. So it can't be that we get, we put in different potentials and then at some case we get the same density. No, that's what can't happen. And again, when I say different here, I mean not, you know, again, I'm excluding the case where they're different by constant. So by V1, V2, V3, I mean substantially different, not just by a constant. So we can't have where there's some V2 that's one shape and we get N2, and V3 that's substantially a different shape without a constant shift and get again N2. So that means that really what we have to get is just, again, some N3. And then you can just see that if that's the case, that you know, N3 can only, once we kind of do this and try to exhaust all, kind of reach all possible densities, then we can flip it around and say once we know the density, it can only have come from one potential. You know, that's the idea. So the idea is that the potential giving it is unique if it exists. So for a given density, given N, V is unique if it exists, right? So then there's a whole, there's a lot of people working on this question, but for what follows, we're not going to be too interested about this question. So basically, you know, in the end, this, you can make a lot of formal statements, but what's really useful about DFT, or what's nice about DFT, is that it's actually useful in practice, right? That's what's really important. So just with this kind of at our backs, we can go on and try to develop useful approximations, and then we can always go back and check individual cases and see if there's some problem with this existence, but in practice, there sort of has never been. People have constructed special cases, but usually these involve kind of funny games involving like divergences and things like that. So most of the time, this part is not a problem. So we won't worry about it overly much. Okay, so that's the thing. So when people say that all properties really come from the density, they really are just saying there's this chain of arrows, right? So N gives you V, V gives you psi, psi gives you everything. But as you can see, it's not a constructive way of getting those things, right? So you know, it's not like having the density just hands you psi. It's just that you know psi must be out there somewhere. And then it's up to you to try to find it. Okay, so another quick consequence. So so Hohenberg-Cohen theorem implies that the energy functional, So for a given potential, there's this energy functional where if you plug in different ends, it'll report back to you what energy that that density would have if it was the ground state density of some problem. And one important consequence about all this logic is that Hohenberg and Cohn argued that the energy can be broken up in this way. So there's this part called F, and then this part that's just the potential, the external potential energy, right? And now here, this is not an operator. This really is just a C number expression. It's the potential integrated with the density. And this part is called the universal, or Hohenberg-Cohn functional, okay? And this name is, I think this name is chosen a little bit for marketing reasons, but what it means, universal just means independent of V, okay? So universal doesn't mean it works for all problems you can imagine. It means it works for this class of problems. It means for this particular T and VEE that you picked. Then there's one F functional that's suitable for all, you know, all cases involving that particular combination of kinetic energy and interactions. And that all the dependence on V is outside of this F. So this is kind of interesting and enticing. And so, you know, because now you can imagine that there's some F that knows about how T and VEE, what value they take for a given density that you might choose to be the ground state density of some problem. And then finally, let me give you a more constructive perspective on what is this F. So there's this construction called the Levy-Leib construction. And what they showed, or what they argued, is that they showed that to understand what F is, just think of a sort of a double minimization. So basically, you just define F as saying, let's minimize over all wave functions constrained to give the certain density that we put here. And let's do this minimization over the expectation value of T plus VEE. So once you see this, it makes the whole thing seem like we have this very kind of non-constructive proof over here, or sort of physicist proof. And then over here is a more constructive way of seeing how this all works. So you kind of take the veil away, right? So the idea is it's just a double minimization. So what we do is we say double minimization, I mean if we try to minimize, so if we think about minimizing this guy to get the ground state information, right? So if we think about minimizing this, what we do is we just do kind of a two-loop thing. So we sort of choose some trial n, and then we minimize over all wave functions that give that n, and then we repeat. Okay, that's sort of like some imaginary algorithm that you could carry out. I mean, in practice, it'd be very, very hard to do. But this is what Levy and Leib were trying to argue about. What do we mean this thing is universal? What we mean is that V here just doesn't appear in this thing. And it's sort of well-defined because you can just say, let me just put some candidate density in here. Then let me just do some very expensive, this isn't something you can really implement, but you can imagine implementing. Go and look over all sort of valid physical wave functions and that have this density until you minimize this. Then defining, kind of wrapping that up as a black box and then throwing it in here, you can just see that if you now kind of choose a trial n, do this minimization over wave functions to sort of lower this as much as possible, this part just is what it is for the n that you chose, then repeat that and then do a search in the space of densities, that eventually you'll find your way to some n naught that gives the lowest value, right? And then that will basically by the Hohenberg-Cohn theorem, once you find this n naught that minimizes, it can only have come from one potential, namely this V. So we know they're sort of partnered up, right? So this must be the ground state density by kind of putting all this together. The fact that these arrows are sort of one-to-one back and forth, right? And let's look at just one more property that this F has that's useful and interesting, and we're going to use it a lot. So
you're saying it's like a general idea, given n to find the potential it associates with by finding this F, and then plot immediately.
Well, in this, you can think about it different ways, but so basically, basically you can, here I was thinking about thinking of V as fixed and defining some particular problem that we want to solve. So we have some electronic structure problem where there's some external V that just comes from the presence of the nuclei. And then we just say that, you know, as I stated earlier, the idea of DFT is that there is this energy functional where you you don't work with wave functions. You just search over the space of densities, which is a much, much easier search to do. And we'll actually construct an algorithm for doing this search that's actually been proved even to converge all the time. So it's a very nice algorithm. The idea is that you never have to touch a wave function, but the reason you don't is secretly there's this machine inside that for every density you feed in does this search over wave functions for you, but only, the interesting part is it only does the search on the kinetic and interaction part. You know, the other part is an explicit density function, so you can pull it out. But this is just nice because it tells you that there's this so-called universal part that just doesn't depend on V. So in some sense, if we can construct that once, then we can use it to solve all problems for all possible different Vs. Right, which would be enough to basically lop off a huge part of kinetic matter physics and just be done with it. If we could just cheaply construct this F. But of course, you know, that's probably too much to hope for. Right? So one other statement is that we said that this N naught is the minimizer of E. So if we take a functional derivative of E of N, right, and then plug in N naught, that this should be an extremal point, so it should get zero. Oh,
sorry, may I ask a question?
Yeah.
I'm just confused. So you recently said that you have a mapping from N to Vs, okay, to the external potential, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, first question is why V has to be varied?
Why does V have to be varied?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's the only thing. I'm not totally sure I understand your question because it's
why can't we fix V, for example? Because usually
we do fix it, but it's fixed yet arbitrary is the thinking, right? It's the only thing that's arbitrary. Everything else has a given form, right? So T and V E are given by, it's just a property of nature. But V, you know, that's where working with different materials comes in, right? So if we take some given, you know, material, that implies some V for the electrons. Then if we, you know, apply pressure, we'll get a different V. But each time, we want to resolve the whole electronic structure problem, right? So we want to think of that as fixed. And then the point is what we've done is we've just argued that it is meaning that you can define some route to obtaining ground state properties only by touching densities. So you never have to touch a wave function in principle if you can construct this box. So somehow you can, you know, ahead of time, this is the way of thinking about it, ahead of time, if you can actually feed in different ends into this F, do these minimizations over all wave functions and get different energies. And the point is you've done this without ever planning for what V you were going to use this for, right? You just do all this work once ahead of time and then put it into a big Excel spreadsheet, right? Of every density on one column and then every value of this, every minimal value of this thing that we searched over all wave functions. You just put that in an Excel spreadsheet and then publish this and get, you know, 20,000 citations or something because everyone's going to want to use this. Then everybody now can come with their favorite V. And all they have to do is search over densities, and every time they propose a new density in this search, they just look in your spreadsheet, grab the value of this thing, you know, and everyone can pull out of the same spreadsheet, and then, you know, just keep doing the search, only ever having to touch densities. So it'd be a very fast search. You could make the search very, very efficient, as long as you could look up and kind of, you know, query these values. That's the idea, right? So you could just make this database of these F values, and then you could just do searches and densities, and you'd be guaranteed to get the exact ground state energy if this spreadsheet was sort of accurate enough. Right, so maybe one day someone will make this, probably not.
So like T is kind of a universal property for electrons. V, E, you've got problems with screening, right?
Well, so that's a good question. So what about screening, right?
I mean, just because it changes like electron, you know, with electrons here, it matters what's in between them.
Right. Yeah, screening just gets built in.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's like you're just saying that like this Fn is dependent upon the structure of VEE.
So. It is, yeah, that's right. So you could put in a screened VEE. But at that point, what you're doing is you're proposing to sort of work in a subset of the electrons. Yeah. So this density would be the density of some of the electrons,
right.
You know. And so people have actually done this. So there's been proposals to deal with sort of different bands in real materials by working with sort of partial densities, where you only include some of the electrons in the story, and you do DFT calculations with some of the density.
Right.
You know. So this actually can be pursued and has been useful for people to do. But that's a more advanced concept. So the point is, as long as this n is the total for all of them, then screening is just an emergent thing that's not, you don't really see it in this formalism. You know, it's somehow, the physics of screening is in this energy, but you don't sort of get to see how it gets put in on this kind of black box approach.
Right, so T plus B is like the universal for all of
Yeah, I mean, so for all kind of realistic problems, we know VE, right? It's the Coulomb interaction.
Exactly.
Now, I mean, this is all kind of within the Born-Oppenheimer approximation.
Yeah.
So then there's a whole kind of another game about how do you go beyond Born-Oppenheimer, right? But you know, I mean, nucleons are fermions too. So in principle, you could probably try to iterate this whole thing for them. But it gets harder, you know. Okay, so one important property real fast, and I think this one's very remarkable, is that if you now just apply this functional derivative to both terms, both of these terms in this universal, well, this universal part and then the external part, you see that you get df of n. And by the way, I mean, I like how you guys are confused about this because it tells me that you're thinking, right? So if you feel confused by this or you feel like this is somehow I'm pulling one over on you, I think you're starting to get it, basically. You know, it's basically very surprising and hard to believe, but I think it also means that it's probably never going to be fully, we're never going to have approximations that work for all systems, is my belief. Because we're going to find that this mapping is overly formal. This is my guess. I'm just guessing here. That there's going to always be systems where there's formally a lot of information in the density, but it's sort of hidden in some way that you can't practically get at it. You know? Okay, so we see we take the functional derivative of f and just leave that there. And then the other part we get is just v of r. Because this part is an explicit density functional, right? It just there's the dependence on v. And so then this just implies that that df of n dn evaluated at, I should say this is at, you know, n equals n naught, is negative v. So again, this is very surprising. I mean, the logic is very simple, but it's a very kind of shocking result because, again, it tells you that if someone went and made this database of f values for every density that you could think of, right? You know, if they just went and did all this heavy lifting once, and again, just only once, that not only would you be able to get ground state energies by then querying this database of f values and then just adding in the potential energy at, you know, as you do the search and do the minimization, but if you could take that space of f values and make a fit, so fit it to some functional form, and then numerically take derivatives of it, right? So take gradients of this thing, that you would find that once you reach this minimizing point, then you went and looked at the gradient at this point, or the functional derivative, it would sort of spit back to you the v that it came from. So somehow it's just wild. So not only does this f just know, based on the density that you feed in, what t and ve, this very complex wave function, the ground state wave function that goes with that n is going to have, but somehow the slope there, or this kind of gradient, knows information about what potential it must have come from, too. And maybe it's not so surprising once you see how it's derived, but it's sort of wild to think about that if you think about this sort of, and again, this can be done once for sort of all problems, you know. That's kind of interesting. And then, you know, maybe the most surprising thing is that there's actually useful approximations for this. Okay, so maybe a little bit of time that remains, let's just talk about the Cohn-Sham construction, right? So this should be relatively easy compared to the other things we talked about. While I'm erasing more questions.
This Fn, it depends from boundary conditions, yeah? It doesn't.
Right, so I mean, yeah, I'm not trying to be overly formal and too correct about everything, so I'm sure there's some dependence on boundary
right,
conditions.
Right, so I'm just saying, like, if I was to consider, like, what I'm going to do here, I'm going to have to, if I wanted to find that F, I would have to treat, like, particle in a box different to say this particle, a free particle, right?
That's right, yeah, I would think so. So I think the safest place to apply, you know, to apply all this work is to say, let's take, you know, you might say, let's take large but finite systems or something of a certain size, you know, and then in the case where you imagine that you're always talking about bound states, a sort of smooth potentials that such that their density decays very fast outside, you know, this kind of thing, and so you have like simple boundary conditions where things just go exponentially to zero at far away. So the Cohn-Sham construction. So Hohenberg-Cohn paper was very important. Then there was this remarkable paper by Cohn and Sham where they so very nice. I encourage you to go look at it. So this is Conan Cham, Fizz Rev 140. I don't know what the A part is about, but A1133 in 1965. And this paper is remarkable because it sort of is two, it's like two big results in one. Where basically they proposed this Cohen-Sham construction, which we'll see is this auxiliary non-interacting system that's going to play a big role in what comes. And they also proposed the local density approximation. So all in one kind of nice and short paper. So, okay, so again, you know, we emphasize that this whole machine was basically, we had a fixed type of interactions, right? Of course, we also had a fixed type of kinetic energy, but that's sort of even more, you know, universal. We always sort of just use the same kind of bare kinetic energy. We found that, you know, having a particular N of R implied that it can only have come from one V of R, right? So if this V exists, it must be unique. That's a good way of saying it, right? That means that, you know, this V of R, of course, goes into some particular interacting Hamiltonian. You can think of this as the Coulomb interaction in 3D. Okay, but that's for a particular fixed type of interaction. So we can think of this arrow going for, you know, some particular interacting case. We can also think about following this arrow for a non-interacting case. And then we get a different V that's again unique if it exists, but it's, you know, the point is it's unique, but it's different from this V in general, right? It doesn't have to be, I guess, but it will be in general. And it's just convention to call this thing VS, and I've been told that the S stands for, some people might guess it stands for sham, but I was told it actually stands for single particle. So we'll be putting S's on different things, and that just means having to do with the non-interacting system. So there's this other Hamiltonian, HS, and this thing defines this thing called the Cohn-Sham system. The Cohn-Sham. The same kinetic energy, no interactions, and then this other potential called VS, right? And it's useful to make a definition where we basically say, let's break VS into two pieces. So you say, and then this part will probably bother you that there's three letters on this thing. We'll talk about what these different letters mean, maybe some of them and maybe not all of them. Okay, so this part is just a definition. So this is just, you know, taking this logic and plugging it in. Here, this is a definition of this thing, right? So it's just a suggestive way of writing the same system, right? So what did we do, right? So we said that there's this arrow that if I know n, it must have only come from one v, at most one v. Maybe no v's, but at most one, right? Again, I know n, now I turn off interactions, just totally leave them out of the picture. I run this map and I get some different v. Define some non-interacting system. We'll see why it's actually useful to do this, but you can always just think about doing it. And then I can take this V, and if I want, I can say, let me imagine some part of this V as actually being the original, you know, interacting, not interacting, but the V that defines the interacting problem. And then some other part. You know, I can always just trivially decompose it. So what I mean is that we're defining VHXC. And again, I'll be telling you what these different letters HXC mean, but for now, let's just think of them as one word, like HXC, right? Like one word. It's just defined as, we can see it, right? So it's just VS minus V of R. So it's kind of like, and the reason I wrote it in this order particularly, right, is that I'm trying to suggest that VHXC somehow accounts for the missing interactions, right? Because as we know, if we just take these and give them to someone and say, solve these two Hamiltonians, this one has interactions, this one doesn't, they'll find out that they get the same density. This is an operator here, I mean, at the moment. But if they solve them, they'll find that the actual C number density they get is the same guy, right? So somehow this VHXC did the job that the interactions do, at least for getting the density, right? I should emphasize that they don't have the same ground state energy, right? I mean, you could add in a constant if you want. You could just put in some kind of correction and make them have the same ground state energy. But I mean, that's only a formal trick you could do. I mean, you'd have to already know what it was. So in practice, it's not so useful to to add that in. You would have already had to know the answer, and then why would you even go through all this, right? And then what we're going to find, we'll talk much more about this tomorrow, is that there's this sort of ongoing debate happening, this sort of always been going on now in this DFT world. Because the point, one point is that there's versions of DFT that make no reference to this Cone-Sham system, right? You can totally omit this part of the story. So you could, like I said, you could try to just, you could imagine taking a very small class of system or something and then actually constructing this table and just working over here, making this table of Fs and just working all in this side of things, right? And this would be called, what's called, people call orbital-free DFT. The reason they call orbital-free is that solving a non-interacting system always involves orbitals because you end up with Slater determinants in general, most of the time, and or sums of Slater determinants. So people call this sort of DFT with orbitals because you're always making reference to some non-interacting system. If you get rid of this non-interacting system and just work over here, they call this orbital-free. And so there's a big pursuit happening where people basically, the work you end up having to do over here is solving this non-interacting system over and over again, and we'll go through that algorithm in the next couple of days. The thing is, even though that should be very cheap, solving a non-interacting system, people always want more, right? So they want to do this many thousands of times and for bigger and bigger and bigger systems. So even the work of solving non-interacting systems is getting to be too expensive for certain kinds of calculations. Basically, these molecular dynamics calculations where you move particles around and then you solve the electronic structure problem every time, or you would like to solve the electronic structure problem every time you move the particles. For big systems, it just gets very expensive. So there's sort of a movement now away from this back to that in some circles. But anyway, the thing is you get this non-interacting system, and its job is, all its job is on some sense, is just to have the same density as the interacting one, right? But then people are always tempted, right? They always see, well, we have this other system that has all these additional physical properties. Like it has some wave function. You know, it has some band structure because it's a non-interacting system. So people want to know, you know, what else can we learn about the physics from this non-interacting system? And we'll see that there are some things. So it turns out that the Cone-Sham system can sort of reflect properties of the interacting system. I say can because I didn't say must, it just can. And there, it turns out there actually are some theorems about certain properties that must reflect, but there's other properties that it just sort of can reflect, but it doesn't necessarily tell you, nothing tells you that it's happening or not. You just have to sort of try and see.
Currently, like we, you know, I give you a problem, I give you some molecule from a quantum chemist, or I give you maybe a macroscopic device in mesoscopic physics or something.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is I'm gonna tell you what T is, what VE is, and what this local potential is.
Mm-hmm.
Now, because that's all I know. So I don't know what VS or VHFC are.
Right.
If I knew one, I'd know the other. Mm-hmm. So to me, the big construction is you know, like, I don't care about the non-interacting system. I do care about the non-interacting system, but in the sense I want to know what VS is. So I'm thinking, like, our whole goal here is to find some way of kind of getting a good approximation to VS.
Okay, so you're saying you have the power to solve an interacting system somehow, or
we have
experimental data.
No, I'm just trying to get like the focus of this is we're
okay.
trying to aim at
yeah.
finding that VS so that we can solve the non-interacting system and get back this NR, which is the right NR for our.
Right. So if I understand your question, you're saying like how do we find VS essentially? You're asking.
Yeah.
Okay. We'll see. It's very surprising that this is the shocking thing about the whole Cone-Sham algorithm is one way of calling it, and this within this LDA approximation. There's other approximations, but we're focused on the LDA because it's simple and it works really well. And the shocking thing is that you really never have to touch the interacting wave function. So you may think that there's no way to sort of cut this knot, right? Like,
right.
This thing is defined to have the same density, but how do you know how to obtain VS? I mean, I'm glad you're seeing this subtlety, right? Because it seems like this is totally unproductive, right? It seems like I would have already had to have N to get VS. You know, so how do I get VS to ever solve this thing to ever get in back, but I already know in. So you kind of go around and around and you think like, what are we doing, right? But the surprising thing is that, and basically it's going to hinge on, to some degree, on the fact that there's this universal part and this derivative gives you V. So what we're going to do, what people have done essentially is create approximations for those more formal objects and then literally take derivatives of them. So you literally do numerics on uniform gases of electrons, interacting gases. So you don't solve this problem, but you solve somehow a related problem where you make V a constant, and you kind of scan through all different constant values we have, and you use very big computers to solve these uniform gas problems. And then you construct approximations to this thing and literally fit them and then take derivatives and then somehow try to feed that all back in. And then it turns out what you do is you never actually get Vs. You get something that is like close to Vs. But you never really get the real one. But this is why I'm sort of going through it this way, is that you'll see many books will immediately start talking about the approximations, and they'll just tell you the algorithm. And what often gets lost in that is that people sometimes lose sight of the fact that there is one. I should emphasize, this thing is unique, right? Again, unique if it exists. But the Hohenberg-Kohn theorem tells you that there's only really, in the end, one Vs, right? And so the thing is, it's very useful when people are developing approximations to always realize that there is some real Vs that you're always shooting for. You never can always get there, but it does exist, and it's worth thinking about its properties if you could construct it, this kind of thing. But sometimes it gets lost in the wash sometimes. So real fast, just to kind of preview of what we'll talk about, is that we'll see that the Cohen-Sham system can be very close in certain senses to the interacting system, surprisingly close. Okay, so it can, and this is one of the most important parts above all, is that the TS, the kinetic energy of Cohen-Sham, can be very close to the real kinetic energy, T. Okay. Not the same as, but it just can be very, it's a very large part of it, right, in many cases. Also, we'll see that sometimes the charge gap, so the charge gap of the Cohen-Sham system, which is a better name for that would be the Cohen-Sham band gap, because there the gap really is just because of some splitting of bands, can be close, but not as close. So let's say this one, let's say it's like, I'll put like three wiggly lines to say this is very close often. This one I'll put one wiggly line to say it's like close-ish to the real charge gap, the actual charge gap. But sometimes it is and sometimes it's not. And we'll explore kind of two cases where it can be and then one case where it's absolutely not. And it's actually 100% error. You know, and it's useful to sort of think about both cases. And that 100% error case will launch us into next week where we're going to discuss ways of dealing with more strongly correlated systems. And then there's other things. There's actually the full band structure. So this is what makes the Cohen-Sham system so tempting, is that you get this whole system where you can solve for all the single particle eigenstates and make these beautiful pictures of band structures. And sometimes they match experiment in a certain sense. You know, you can do experiments that you can line up points on top. I'll show you tomorrow, hopefully, some of these pictures. So it's very tempting to say that, you know, this is what you'll see in many talks. You'll see the band structures of the system displayed. But you know, if you're a real formal person, you would say these things are meaningless in the most formal sense. But that's not generous enough, right? And we know now from experience that they actually are meaningful in many cases. But again, if you're just being kind of an absolutist or a formalist, you would say this is just a totally artificial construction. It has no meaning whatsoever, et cetera, et cetera. It's just that in practice, it actually tends to be pretty a good picture of the real system. And there's other things. There's the position of the position of the highest occupied single particle state. So this is a statement about a thing called Koopman's theorem. So basically, you can show that the energy for removing one electron from the system is the same in the interacting and this non-interacting system. So that what I'm trying to say is that formally, this thing is only has sort of one job, and its job is to just give the same density. So formally, that's all it is. It's just some kind of scaffolding for giving you a certain density in the middle of some algorithm. But then it's a nice fact that other interesting information can sort of spill out of this formal construction.
So if I had a Fermi liquid with, like, you know, fairly small electron interactions, and I do DFT on it, are you telling me that, you know, I could expect to see a band structure that rough, you know, with like the energies roughly matching what right. I'm seeing, you know, if I went through the full Fermi liquid theory and got out like a bunch of, you know,
that's right.
Effective masses, let's see something similar.
That's exactly right. So very, very good question. So the question is that if you go through Fermi liquid theory, so Fermi liquid theory, I mean, that's what I like about DFT, is that Fermi liquid theory is a sort of a lot of propositions that have been made over time more and more rigorous. This is like another very totally rigorous approach. that sort of parallels Fermi-liquid theory. So its development was, you know, sort of in parallel. I mean, of course, I'm sure all the people who made it, of course, knew a lot about Fermi-liquid theory, but it doesn't necessarily involve it. So you kind of, in the end, reach somewhat similar conclusions through two kind of different logical avenues. So Fermi-liquid theory, you basically say, non-interacting electrons, let's sort of perturbatively imagine adding interactions, and you show that certain properties of the original very sharp quasi-particles remain. So basically, their locations in these bands just sort of shift a little bit. They broaden, so instead of being these perfectly long-lived quasi-particles, they broaden. This can be seen in like photo emission experiments. So they actually, you can actually go and eject electrons near the Fermi surface out and met, you know, kind of see how sharp the signal is, and you can, you know, get their lifetimes from this picture. And you can make these plots and then overlay them on the band structures from Cohen-Sham calculations, and they match in certain cases.
But you can't get like a lifetime out of Cohen-Sham because it's a non-interacting problem.
That's a good question. So I'll just have to punt on that. I don't know if you can get a lifetime out of Cohen-Sham. I mean, people have been, in the intervening years, people have been very clever about what they can get out of DFT calculations. So I won't say that they can't. I mean, probably someone knows how to. But exactly, so this is what I kind of like about it. It's like, so for people like me who are very concrete and don't like sort of hand-wavy stuff, not that, I mean, Fermi-liquid theory is now well beyond hand-wavy. It's sort of been put on much firmer footing by some work of like, there's an RG picture, a renormalization group picture of Fermi-liquid theory that's been developed by Shankar that's very nice. But anyway, the point is that this is now an alternative way of sort of getting at the same intuition, that there is some kind of non-interacting system that can mimic the real one. This is a kind of an uncontrolled approximation, though. That's the point, is when you open up the Cohen-Sham system and you look at anything but its density, you're doing an uncontrolled approximation. So it never raises a red flag to you and says, don't trust anything about me, right? It doesn't tell you that. You just have to go off and compare it to some experiment and just see. So you could also think about running this logic backwards. So instead of it being a prediction of the band structure of some interacting system in some sense, you could just think about measuring some, you know, quasi-particle locations, comparing to this, and then what you've learned is that the thing is well described by non-interacting system. So you've learned that maybe it's a weakly correlated system in that particular sense. So it's not so much of a prediction, but it's like a post-diction, if you will, that like you've learned that the system, after all that work, really was kind of morally non-interacting or something.
Is there any work going into, I mean, I guess I can't think of any way of doing it, but has anyone had any way of finding ways of throwing up red flags about DFT apart from just comparing it with the actual results?
Yeah, I like this question. So the question is, you know, can we make it, can we put error bars on DFT calculations in some sense? So can we make a DFT calculation report back to us and tell us basically, don't trust me, you know?
Yeah.
It can tell you like, here, you've gotten some result, but it'll tell you that you can't trust the result you've gotten in some sense.
Yeah.
So there's one particular line of work I like, which is by Kieran Burke and collaborators at Irvine. So he's doing this thing where, there's this long game where people have been following this route called empiricism in DFT. So what they do is instead of constructing things like the LDA, where you use sort of very, this is unique and you use sort of formal arguments and things, people are just making up functionals with sort of more and more and more parameters, and then they're fitting these parameters to data sets of large different molecules and things. It's kind of more on the side of where I was saying if you make a big database. So then what Burke and collaborators have been doing is trying to push this really far. So that is sort of dangerous in the empiricism because, you know, you just made it work on some problems, but how do you know it's going to work on others? But if you push this to its uttermost limit, what you do is you basically put in as many fitting parameters as you can afford. So this is the idea of machine learning. Mm-hmm. Some people call it artificial intelligence, but I think it's just high-dimensional curve fitting in some sense. And so you basically just put in a bajillion parameters, and then you feed in different densities, and then you just construct F for all these different densities. And then the idea is you have like a training set of densities, and then you let these machine learning algorithms fit all the, you know, kind of interpolate between the training densities. And the bottom line of getting to your question is that one of the points of doing this is that then when you feed, finally in some real calculation, like one of these molecular dynamics calculations, when you feed in a density that goes outside of the training set, the machine learning algorithm code yells at you and says, don't trust this anymore. I'll give you a result, but it comes with a big, you know, warning sign attached to it saying it's way outside of the training set. So you can actually get an error bar of the sense that way.
Right,
so
that's kind of a bound on the error.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you can have a...
Yeah.
I mean, I guess, you know, if I do say exact diagonalization with answer, I can find, you know, I can say, turn around and say, okay, Well, usually if I run it, usually just spits back out zero if it doesn't convert. But it has a definite kind of convergence rate. It's got a convergence interval it can measure. Mm-hmm. You can't actually get this with DFT. You can't just like
rip. Yeah, that's so. This is a big criticism people have of DFT. It is uncontrolled, but you know people do a lot of uncontrolled approximations.
Yeah, no, nonetheless, this makes it wrong. I was wondering if people have been able to think of any way of getting.
I don't know if there's really like a more formal or sort of constructed kind of analytical way of getting there. But maybe there could be. So this is what I mean about I think this is actually a really rich field. There's a lot of research that could still be done in this field. So sometimes people see it as an old school story or some numerics thing, but I think it's really deep. So okay, I'll kind of wrap up for today and then you guys can ask me some more questions after.